Welcome back to another episode of the Chats with Clark podcast. I'm your host, Joe Clark, and here at Chats with Clark, we don't do poppy intros. And the point today of episode 49 is Johnny Cole. Johnny, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you. And I wanted to read an intro from one of your Instagram bios. So Johnny has started a company called Hey Brother Co. And the bio reads as such. Creating the next generation of emotionally skilled men, one conversation at a time. Johnny, touch on it a little bit. What's Hey Brother Co? Tell me about the mantra.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So Hey Brother Co is my men's work organization. And men's work refers to any organized practice of self-development for men and boys to do in community with one another. Currently, there aren't enough examples of spaces and or models of healthy masculinity, and men and boys are really struggling. We can see this in so many different metrics, but one of the most common ones to refer to is mental health, suicide statistics, self-harm, but also a feeling of loneliness and isolation. A lot of men and boys are feeling lonely and emotionally disconnected. So I founded a company with our entire mission is to build up the emotional skills of men and boys so that we can improve our mental health outcomes and so that we can form strong connections and community bonds with one another and unlearn some of those problematic things we've been taught about what it means to be a man.
Sure. That's awesome. I feel like, Johnny, there has to be some sort of start, right? So, of course, you an innate start when you started your business. But yeah. Prior to that, there had to be thoughts in your mind where you were like, wait a minute, this doesn't add up. And for me, like, I got to think about it this way. So what was it from your upbringing, from your past, from what made you you that led you to kind of think this way or say, hey, I want to step into this space and really make a charge?
Yeah. So I was raised in a household that, to be completely candid, my father was very abusive, physically, emotionally, verbally, financially. And so being that he was also a special forces veteran from another country, he had a bit of a militaristic kind of philosophy as well that he raised me up into. And so when I think about what some of the most traditional elements of what it means to be a man, like being physically dominant, getting what you want through intimidation, or those were things that I grew up having modeled for me. And it was pretty terrifying, but also really confusing because I was a naturally very sensitive, emotional, empathetic boy. And because of the contrast between my dad's behavior and treatment of me, and then how I innately felt about myself, it caused me to believe there was something wrong with me and that these qualities of emotional sensitivity or kindness or natural inclinations for empathy are just something that real men, that boys shouldn't have. And that caused a lot of internal conflict. And fast forward, 20 plus years and a bunch of other anecdotes and details, but the shorter version is that I, for the longest time, was really seeking connection in a community sense with other men because it was a gap in my life. And there were a lot of times when I felt I was creating individual friendships with men who were not ready to kind of emotionally reciprocate in the way that I felt ready to show up. But I could see that there were a lot of men who were also in pain and feeling the same like lack in their life. And so I decided to do something about that in my mid-20s because I couldn't like kind of handle it anymore. I was like, there's so many contradictions about what I feel I need to do and how I feel I need to act and dress and speak, because that's what society or film or media and or the model for my dad says I need to do versus how I feel I truly want to express myself or move through the world. So yeah, that's the very long version.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Before we kind of dive into it, how has the relationship with your dad grown or strained, I guess, as a result of all of this?
Yeah. So I've been no contact with my dad for a little over, almost 6 years now. And that was a pretty significant decision in my life has caused a lot of grief for me because especially in my earlier 20s, I thought that it was, I was losing access to this potential for a paternal relationship that I'd always wanted. But now having a lot of time in therapy and to process and diving into men's work and having a really solid community of men who do love me, I've realized like I was kind of yearning for a relationship that never would be possible with him. And so my decision to go no contact with him was based also in my values of like not aligning with men who abuse and also deciding to align with my mom and my sister and show up for them and show up for myself as well. So it has definitely caused a lot of like internal turmoil and emotional turbulence and also has been extremely liberating. because I would not be the man that I am, who I'm very proud of, without making that decision. And I think there are a lot of men who, even if they don't share that specific story, feel very similarly, where they're at odds. They feel in a catch-22 position where do I choose to align with kind of this traditional or like patriarchal value system, right? Like maintain relationships with someone who is harmful, or keep acting in a certain way because I think it's going to give me access to something, right? Like this possibility of a great relationship with a dad. Or do I go against the grain and choose a really hard thing, but like stop doing these behaviors, or, you know,
sure.
Yeah. So,
yeah, it's difficult, right? Because you want to, there's a certain sense of respect with that, right? It's like, oh, this is my father. Like there's an inherent, like, that is how life was brought about. So there's, I feel like almost biologically, there's just an innate, like you're kind of, yeah, like you're saying, like you're like, okay, now I feel like torn on it, right? It's kind of like, well, I know this isn't really the best dynamic for me. And I know that it's really not going to evolve, but there's a certain gravitational pull that's almost like, that causes that friction, I feel like.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, because when I was growing up, and even it was really confusing. Like when people speak about, you know, domestic violence or abuse, and October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, it's not as cut and dry as maybe what we would think from a movie. So maybe people think there's, you know, a bottle of whiskey and a black eye is like our pretty common conception of what DV entails. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, there are these explosive events that happen, but there's a lot of time in between where there's cycles of just more subtle mistreatment, and then also different mechanisms that an abuser asserts power and control over a family unit or over a romantic partner. And it can also be very, what's the word, like intoxicating almost, that you do want to be treated well, especially from a partner or a parent. And so even as a result or as a response to abuse, children can often lean into wanting to work harder for that affection. So that's my way of saying, for a really long time, I like looked up to my dad despite the fact that he scared me and did not treat us well. And I did try to model a lot of my life off of how I thought he, you know, would respect, which means I tried to fit into a lot of the traditional man boxes. I got into fights in college. I started, you know, trying to play a lot of sports and just represent a lot of these traditional elements of masculinity, thinking that he would respect me for that because he was someone who viewed the world in this lens, and none of it really worked. So that was an initial contradiction that I realized. I was like, oh, I'm like putting time into all these inputs thinking I'm going to get this result, but it's not making anything better. And then in my last year of college, I ended up getting an internship at a domestic violence center, and worked there for a year. And on the first day of training, we basically were introduced to the dynamic nature of DV. And so that was actually as when I was 21, it was my first time ever seeing how dynamic it can be. And it's not just based on that media representation. And I had an actual, like, I want to call it like a come to Jesus type moment. Mm-hmm. Had to go and take a moment from the training session, go to the bathroom and like shake, because I saw so much of my life flash before my eyes. Yeah. and everything kind of shifted into place. And that was kind of right around when I decided to cut him off as well. So,
wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. And Johnny, we were kind of talking a little bit about it before the episode began, like to all our audience, this is kind of the root for me, right? There's always a rationale. There's always a story. There's always a thought process that is interwoven into what we do. And so I feel like for you, like, crazy experience, right? So like we as an audience, I say that as me and whoever is listening, like it's a very important pivotal story in your life. And then it's also a moment where you became even more of who you were called and wanted to be. And that has then, of course, turned into Hey Brother Co. too. But last piece of it that I wanted to touch on before we go into it, how about the relationship with your mom and your sister? Because they also went through it too. And I feel like they're another, again, pivotal part of the story.
Yeah, great question. So one of the things that my dad did really, really effectively through my upbringing was try to convince me that any proximity to women or femininity was shameful, right? So like mama's boy type tropes, and, you know, don't let women wrap you around their finger. And you're only, if he and I ever had a conflict where I would be upset with things that he would say about my mom or my sister or his treatment, I would try to address it with him. He would essentially try to tell me, like, the only reason that I'm upset with that is because that it's my mom and my sister, and then like women, or the women in our family have convinced me that, you know, there's something wrong with it. And that is a very common rhetoric of, again, like this like capital P patriarchal value system where men try to convince one another, like, it's not that deep, or, you know, hey, like, women are so dramatic, or whatever. And so from ages like 12 or so, that had a huge impact on me. And I tried to distance myself from my mom and my sister, like emotionally and relationally. And then when I went away to college, and I was still trying to navigate like my relationship with my father and forming my own identity as a young man and in the university setting, I didn't have a ton of closeness with my mom and my sister. And there were a lot of other stuff, other things happening in our household and like with my sister's health. But when I did choose to end my relationship with my dad, I would say there had been years of pretty distinct emotional disconnection from both of them. And there hadn't been a lot of time to collectively, like as a three-person unit, process our shared experience with him.
Yeah.
And so the past, I would say like 3 to 4 years of my life has really been leaning into my relationship with my mom and my sister. And, you know, we've started attending family therapy very, very recently together. And I now have completely like transformed those relationships, and I'm so, so grateful for their presence in my life, but it took some time, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Honestly, Johnny, I was thinking it had to be almost like an anecdotal evidence sort of piece for your company, because for them to go through it too, you knew that they had it, except it's gonna be different because we're all different, right? And the experiences that you're gonna have as a young dude, as opposed to what they're gonna have as a wife, as the daughter, is gonna be different. But for you to be able to mend that and to say, hey, like, let's bolster each other and put our relationship first, that, because none of you are making the bad decision, right? It's like you can't change the bad decisions of bad behavior as much as we might want to try. That's more than likely not going to be the case. So it's like we got to take the part that's inherently been affected and still inherently good,
yeah,
and make it even better. And that's your relationship. So I almost like I knew it was going to go that way. I just knew, given the fact that you've done this business and you're starting it. So
yeah.
Without further ado, hey, Brother Co, 2020, you were 21. So at that point in time, how did you decide to kickstart it? What does it look like? What was the vision?
Yeah. So I didn't start Hey Brother Co in 2021. I didn't start it when I was 21 either.
Okay.
That is when I was working at the Domestic Violence Center, and I started to realize, like, in working in direct service with people who were affected by, you know, the same thing my mom and sister and I were affected by. I was one of the only male staff members, and I was also, our facility only did intakes with, you know, women and children. And I started thinking to myself, like, who is speaking to men, not just perpetrators of the most severe forms of abuse, but in general, who is having conversations with men about all of these behaviors that we perform that lead to abuse? Because a lot of it, in my opinion, stems from pressures we feel to adhere to a certain standard of masculinity that tends to prioritize like controlling behaviors or asserting one's dominance or getting respect or just like feeling in control and feeling powerful, this need to feel powerful and entitled. But most men who do abuse, I think, are themselves very traumatized, which does not excuse the behavior. So these were very initial, like early, like wheels turning thoughts. And at the same time, in my last year of college as interning at this facility, I also started taking gender studies classes. So I had an academic breakdown of what are these words, feminism, patriarchy, gender. Like, I had heard them in news and media and had somewhat familiarity, but I had never really like learned about some of these systems, like the value system of how are we as men conditioned from boyhood to think about what it means to be a man. Like, that there's actually some rhyme and reason to that. Like, there's some universality to a lot of our experience. And fast forward, I graduated from university. I moved to North Carolina to start my first job in the, you know, in the private sector, in the tech world. And I'm really feeling that like early 20s, COVID, disconnection from community, because you go from living at school and walkable community to then like COVID isolation. Plus, I'm now like working in the workforce and still not feeling a super level, big level of connection with, you know, other guys. And like I had, you know, new city, all that. So it took me a while of like feeling quite sorry for myself and lonely and isolated. My mental health took a hit, but I decided finally in 2022, when I was 24 years old, I think I want to get together a group of guys that I know, because I do actually have some really solid men in my life on an individual level who we're all old enough now. We have that emotional skill set, but it's A, none of them live near me, and B, none of them know each other, and we've never gotten together as a group. And that really is what I felt I was missing. So I invited 25 men from around the country and who were associated with me either through college or through, you know, work or childhood or whatever. And eight of them were able to make it and make time in their schedule to show up and fly out to Minneapolis, where I was living at the time. And I led a men's retreat. I invited them all, and I filmed this video to tell them exactly what it was. I was like, I think we all, like, I know you guys all, I think we would really benefit from a concentrated weekend to discuss some of the things that we're going through and also some of the universality of our experience. And it fundamentally changed my life to step into leadership in that capacity. And also, it gave me purpose. I was like, oh man, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, you know? It was beautiful. And for a group of eight men who did not know each other when they arrived on a Friday afternoon to Monday afternoon, all crying at the airport, saying goodbye to one another because of the intensity of connection that they created over the weekend.
That's incredible. How did you cultivate that within the retreat? I mean, first go at it, and you have that effectiveness is quite impressive.
Yeah, it was super daunting, and I didn't have any formal training. I think a lot of that propensity for leadership and then also creating safety for men to be vulnerable is something that's quite innate to me. And I did reach out to a couple kind of men's coaches that I had seen on Instagram. And this is when I was kind of like first learning about men's work, because it's still quite fringe and not a lot of people know. Like, if you say the word men's work, they don't know. But I had like one or two Zoom calls with one coach, specifically Voy Viacek, who had taught me a couple like breathwork techniques and gave me some ideas. But I really designed a curriculum based on what I thought men needed to talk about, and then supplemented that with those breathwork techniques and some kind of inner child meditations that I had found on YouTube and felt I could write out a script for and actually lead guys through. And then I designed some guided journal prompts and discussion questions that we could do in small groups and also take solo time. And then I made sure we would screen a documentary called The Mask You Live In by the Representation Project, which features a now mentor of mine, Ashanti Branch. And it's all about the socialization of boys in America to learn masculinity and this mask that we put on to perform. And so this culmination of different activities that I designed, as well as like a communal meal plan where we would all like cook together and then eat every meal together and just really build this sense of solidarity over the course of the weekend. It was really amazing. It was a lot of hard work. It was super scary, but it went exceptionally well. And when I say it was this like divine lightning rod, I was like, oh my God, like, there was a specific moment where I had all eight of these guys were in a circle, laying down in the lawn right on the Mississippi River in kind of a northern part of Minnesota where the retreat was held. And I was leading them through an inner child meditation, and all of them were crying. And like, I knew a couple of the guys had not cried in years, maybe had not confronted or thought about some of their experiences in quite a long time, but all of them were having this like very visceral emotional reaction. And then leading them gently out of that meditation space, having them pair off and do some like eye gazing and some comfort of one another, breaching that physical contact. That is this moment where I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm doing this. Like this is so amazing. And like, look what I've created. But also they so desperately needed this, like that, you know, every single one of them, like, and so that set the stage. So I took a couple months to like plan out after that retreat over 4th of July weekend in 2022. I took a couple months to think like, well, how could I make this a thing? And then in January of 23, I like formed my company, launched a website and a social media page, started offering like virtual men's groups and planning my next few retreats. That's what's been happening.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And as you go, as with anything, right? Like any educator in your own way, tailors as they go, right?
Yes.
You develop and you keep perfecting, and you have new ideas and just keeps building. And then the next thing you know, you're whatever, 40 retreats in, and it's like, oh my gosh, like, this is rocking. How many retreats have you done so far?
I have led 5 retreats since that first one.
So is that always the best part? The in-person retreat, like, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
That kind of connection.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the best parts, but it's also some of the most like logistically intensive and stressful. Like retreats don't tend to be like I allow a lot of, I provide scholarships for a lot of men. So I do a lot of things like at cost at present, because I want to ensure that any type of man like has access to this sure. work, because I truly believe like every man needs men's work. And so to that effect, it can be difficult to sustain a large number of retreats, given that they're not very profitable at this point in time, which maybe we shouldn't include that in the podcast. And I should be like, no, they're, you know, these like luxury experiences, but they're really amazing. However, yeah, it's also, I work full time and right. I have, you know, a lot of other things in my life. So I can't do as, you know, 10 a year. I usually do like two or three. But one of the things that I did to challenge myself right after I formed the company is in January of 2023, I set this intention and I was like, I'm going to lead a father-son retreat. Like, I don't know of any other men's groups or men's organizations out there that lead intergenerational, like father-son experiences. And I don't mean like for boys, like bonding, like a, you know, Boy Scouts. Or, yeah. I mean, like they're all of the men that I know who are doing this work with me, a lot of them also have, if not fractured relationship with their dads, just not the level of emotional closeness that they would wish. Like if I asked any of my friends and, you know, candidly, like, hey, like, do you think you wish you'd like hugged your dad more? Do you wish that you could have more frank conversations with him? Do you guys think you say you love each other enough? And a lot of those answers are no, even if they still do feel close to their dad. They're just like, oh, there sure. could be more there. So despite, like, in spite of my own relationship or lack thereof with my father, I still so strongly believe in the power of like the father-son connection. And I wanted to lean into discomfort and say, like, even though this is a big wound for me, it is something that fathers and sons need. So I led a father-son retreat over Father's Day weekend last year and did it again this year. Yeah. And it's super profound to do this work for men in general, but then to see it happen with like from teenage to adult fathers and sons to like reconnect and establish that closeness that we've kind of been denied is really amazing.
Question for you, to what degree do you think that some sort of discomfort, some sort of suffering is almost necessary for it? Because just hearing your story, right, it's a catalyst for you to develop the company that you're doing and the work that you're doing. So without it, again, it's a hypothesis, but the hypothesis would be that maybe you wouldn't have gotten into it if everything was, you know, green grass yeah. prior to. So to what degree is there a need for suffering in order to make some of these changes, or to, like, again, the need for discomfort to say, like, you know what, then this maybe isn't where I want it to be, that, and to get it to that point?
It's a wonderful question, because, and I think we can, I can add on to it to talk like about David Goggins and some of that, you know, culture that we had spoken about before we started the episode. But I am absolutely like here today and the man that I am today, not in spite of everything I've been through, but because of it. Absolutely. Like, and that is, again, a pretty recent realization. Like, I'm 27 now. I've been in weekly therapy for a year. I've been doing some really intense work to recover from, you know, my complex post-traumatic stress disorder and also heal with my mom and my sister. And coming out of that and how I feel now is not like maybe the chip on my shoulder, feeling like more of a victim than I did in my early 20s. Like, especially when I first cut my dad off, I was hurting for a really long time. And I was very resentful of the world. I was very jealous of guys who had great relationships with their dads, who I felt like didn't appreciate it. You know, I was like super like miring in my hurt, because it was very real. And also, I have now shifted a perspective to be like, whoa, yeah, like I would not, without the very unique like South African special forces, like very, very particular battalion, you know, dad that I had that did very certain things, like, and without some of my natural inclinations and, you know, being able to take a year of gender studies courses and then have this internship opportunity and all of the mentorship that I'd received along the way and all of this and all whatever, I would not be here. And actually, those experiences were kind of by design. Like, it's not that they held me back to, and I got through it. It's that they helped curate me into the person that I am today doing what I do. And I am very proud of the man that I am. I'm really excited about the direction that my life is going. I love the work that I do. And I think it's really, really important. And so that is something that, like, I'm going to say with my full chest.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think that in order to do men's work or in order to benefit from this or engage with this self-actualization, really, and discovering what kind of man you want to be instead of what type of man you think you have to be, that does not require intense trauma or or suffering. And the work itself reveals grief, but it is not, and the discomfort that's present is really just discomfort because it's uncomfortable to be vulnerable when you haven't done it a lot or you don't have a practice. And some of my co-leaders and the other guys in the group, like, they don't have the same stories I do. They've struggled with different things or with, like, mental health and all of that as well, but they still greatly benefit and are, like, are all in and without having to have the same backstory, you know? And where I want to go with that, this principle that, like, do you have to grind or do you have to suffer or go through some sort of gauntlet to become a fully actualized person? I do think that there are people who, because they've experienced trauma, are incredibly resilient and have a, like, more empathy and a greater perspective on life and are able to understand that, like, the human condition, like, a lot of people suffer, and it's not just about me. I think that's really powerful. And also, I think in our culture of masculinity, men tend to, like, glorify a type of discomfort that is suffering and, like, normalizes self-abuse. And when I bring David Goggins into it, I mean, we sometimes fantasize about, like, if my leg is broken, I'm still going to hobble across the race finish line. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm going to ignore my feelings, ignore my physical pain, ignore what my body's telling me, ignore what's in my head, and just suppress and get through it and, like, get hard, stay hard. And if you don't stay hard, then you're a fucking bitch. And you better not be a fucking bitch. That's the worst thing in the world. So, like, doesn't matter if your arm is broken or whatever. And I think that type of self-talk and that type of mindset is normalizing self-abuse. And if you normalize the abuse of yourself and your own body and treating yourself like that, you are much more likely to think it's okay to treat other people like that. And I think that David Goggins has motivated a lot of people, and that's amazing. I would love to hear what type of father he is and what his relationship is like with his daughter and how he shows up in his home environment when he's not, like, screaming at the camera and the audience, like, get hard, bitch. Like, and I want a lot of, I know for a fact that there are a lot of men who can do amazing things and push their body to a great limit with positive reinforcement, with someone saying, I believe in you. You got this. One more rep. You're strong. You can fucking do this. I think that does still produce incredible athletes and cultivate resilience. And then the last thing I will say on this diatribe is from Gabor Mate, who is a renowned psychotherapist and trauma expert. He has an anecdote where he says the root word of discipline is disciple. And while I don't come from a religious background, I think this anecdote is very beautiful because Jesus and other figures in society that are well-loved and are leaders, Jesus specifically had disciples. And a disciple is someone who willingly follows because of the example that you set, not because you shamed them or scared them into adhering to your standard, right? Everyone followed Jesus' example willingly. And when we think about discipline as punishment, I'm going to cultivate and discipline you into doing this thing or into showing up in a certain way, we are fundamentally denying ourselves of the joy of self-confidence in pushing someone to be their best self, right? Like that negative reinforcement mindset, you know, that's not what discipline is. And we also do a really big disservice to fathers by saying fathers should be disciplinarians and enforce and discipline is punishment. So fathers should be the punishers. I don't think that's fair to dads. And I think it's because we don't understand that discipline can be just cultivated through encouraging someone and not just through punishing and by modeling and leading by example so that someone else is inspired to follow suit.
I think it's really difficult to captivate it all in a moderate sense because Goggins is extreme, right? But also to ignore any pain is probably extreme as well. So I ask you this, for someone like Goggins who's saying cross the finish line with a broken leg, and then someone on the opposite side who says, well, the second that you feel the pain, like, then stop. Mm-hmm. I think there's a middle ground that is almost so essential because in order to build a muscle, we must tear it, right? So if you're lifting weights, those first reps, It's like you're feeling okay. By the end of that 10th rep, it's like all of a sudden your arms are sore, right? By the 15th rep, and now you're like, okay, can I go on? Mm-hmm. And so while I think, of course, it's valid, the positive, like the Goggins is going to be in your face screaming you, like you put the thing down again, like you were saying, you're soft, whatever. To have the positive reinforcement of, I think of a guy like Ed Mylett, who I adore, like he's a fantastic speaker. I've mentioned him several times recently, but he's a big, like, no, like one more, like his big mantra is one more. Mm-hmm. One more, and he calls it max out by doing one more every time. If you do one more every day, it's 365 days of one more.
Yeah.
And then if you do that in everything, of course it amplifies. But so his idea would be no, like one more. So how do you balance and manage the essential moderation, I think, almost to have both ends of the spectrum meeting somewhere in the middle?
Yeah. I think what's really important is I think it should be your choice if you want to push through pain or discomfort of any kind in any setting, not just in winning a race or like doing an ultra marathon or whatever. I want your thought process, or a man's thought process, or but anyone. My leg hurts, I'm cramping up. Man, if I don't keep going, I'm a bitch, which, and bitches are feminine, I can't be that, I'm scared. I'm gonna feel shame. I'm gonna feel compromised in my identity if I don't do this. And I don't want that to be the motivating factor. So I think it is okay if in your mind, if the mindset is just like, legs are cramping up, but I think I can do this. I got this. All right, one more. You know, and that's what, and so yeah, like at the end of the race, you're like, oh man, like I need a rest because my leg hurt because I pushed. That's okay. The process, if it's intentional, if it's your decision, the process of ignoring or accepting pain in order to accomplish a goal, that's not what I have a problem with. But if the motivating factor to accept that pain and accomplish the goal is that you are afraid of shame and you've got this, again, this like negative reinforcement and specifically that patriarchal mindset that if I don't do this, I am the word that I'm associated with is like an insult or feminine or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's the mindset I'm trying to get men to change.
Yeah, so it's less the result. It's more the modus.
Yes.
Like the driving force.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what about someone who's both, who finds motivation in both? Tom Brady, who I think is a great individual, has a lot of really outstanding qualities, was on an episode with Patrick Bet David, sitting down there having a conversation. Really, it was actually during a retreat. Patrick Bet David was hosting a four-day retreat, and Brady was on there, and one of his big things is like he finds motivation in a lot of different things. Patrick Bet David was pushing him, like, Was it Jordan or was it Belichick? Was it having more rings than Jordan? Was it having more wins than Belichick to push Brady to win the last Super Bowl in Tampa Bay that he won, putting him above both of those? And Brady deferring was always saying, like, no, the motivation was, like, I wanted to be the best of myself that I could be. And then another facet for him was, like, it's a big, right? He was doubted his whole career. He's been doubted when he was in Michigan. He was a backup. He would go in, go out, go in, go out. Same thing. So then when he got to New England, it was like, when you put me on the field, you're never going to take me off, kind of thing. Bledsoe goes down and comes Brady. And they never took him off.
Yeah.
So how do you, and that's, I mean, that's like spite, right? And a certain, like, if you want to put like a cynical word on it, it's almost like a spite and anger.
Yeah.
So how, he tapped into that, but he also tapped into this, like, no, like, I want to do this for me and for the people that I love, like, be the best that I possibly can. So someone like Brady, who dabbles in both, what are your thoughts on that?
I find that to be a really, you know, inspiring and acceptable story. Like, I think that right now, most men and young boys do resonate more with this style of content we see online. I'm sure you've seen it, where it's like, battle your demons in the gym. And maybe it's like a Jordan Peterson voiceover or soundbite over a clip of like a guy with like a hoodie and like his headphones on. And he's like, like, you know, learn to control the wolf or the beast or whatever. Like, so that type of, I'm going to say like kind of like alpha or maybe like negative reinforcement, like battle the demons, use physical fitness or that negative reinforcement as your motivator to deal with something else in your life, to deal with pain that you're going through. I would say that's more common and there is less of that moderate approach. You know, Tom Brady is an exceptional athlete that is like one of the world's best athletes, you know, like paid a lot of money to play that game. So whatever works for him, you know, that's awesome. But I also would hope that for him as like a man, that he has a good relationship with himself and like loves himself. And I and knows that he is worthy, even if he does not accomplish XYZ. I mean, he has already, but so yeah, I don't know if this is maybe like a lukewarm in the middle answer, but you know, that's great for Tom Brady, but I more speak to like the general population, or like the average man who's not going to be a professional football player.
Yeah, but. The reason I think like we don't really know, that's part of the joy of like the podcast, right? Is like we're in Cleveland, like that's why I love having the conversations with people that are local, that are doing the thing and aren't on a Brady scale. I mean, Brady, right. Of course, but I feel like those are the stories that are vocalized. So it's kind of like you use Jesus, and of course, everyone knows, you know, everyone knows
Jesus.
So I feel like we're just kind of forced into that. But the reason I like the Brady example is because, frankly, I mean, there's nothing impressive about him, like physically or anything aside from, he was tall.
Yeah.
He was slow. He didn't have the greatest arm. Like it was all those, like in the comparison to, of course, other professional quarterbacks. I feel like that's kind of why I chose that one as the example.
Well, that like, F you, watch this, like type of, you mentioned that word spite, like, again, it motivated him to great heights. And I don't want to be the guy that comes in and like starts disparaging like people, but I want to bring to attention, like, what is his, you know, family or home life like? And I do believe like there was some contention, you know, in his marriage or former marriage now. I'm just going to say like, amazing what you've accomplished and how much money he's made, and like great, like super awesome man, but like how are you in here and how are you with the people who are closest to you? How do they take that? Because I do think that over time, too much of that like negative reinforcement extreme or fueling yourself based off of spite or whatever it is does have a net negative impact on your own soul and emotional health and well-being, and absolutely, it then permeates out. And the story as old as time is, you know, we as capital M men who do that, our pain is metabolized by everyone around us, whether it's like wives or children or community members or coworkers or whatever. So,
The whole pot idea, right? The pot boils and eventually it goes over.
Exactly.
And then what that looks like is, of course, disgusting because it's going to be something that no man wants to be, I would imagine.
And I think that, you know, boys who bottle up their tears become men who drown, you know, truly. And that is, you said the pot is a beautiful analogy, because what so many men who are struggling, whether it's with like anger issues or just in general, like struggle with emotional processing, as most of us do, it's because we actively choose to suppress, right? So repression, if something's repressed, it's like hidden away, but a suppression is a verb, it's active. I am actually choosing to push it down. And for example, that like lump in your throat that maybe you used to get a lot more when you were a boy, that is a somatic, like physical response to external stimulus. That's your body's telling you, oh, like I'm going to cry soon because there's a lump in the throat, and maybe that's the early sign that the tears are going to come. So when we shame boys for crying as early as, you know, 4 or 5, whatever, boys don't cry, boys are strong. We're teaching them, hey, when you feel that physical signal, swallow it, push it down, suppress, intentional decision. I used to do that. You know, and then we grow into men who have habituated this relationship with our body where we've suppressed feelings, where we actually become quite numb, but we've stuffed it all down and we've accumulated what at Hey Brother Code kind of we call an emotional debt. Like we're actually carrying that debt around, like the, you know, the IRS, the bank's going to come at some point. And when we pile and pile and pile and suppress and suppress and suppress, it's actually sometimes something quite small that can boil the pot over.
Right.
And that is why a lot of men and our families will see us like either like explode or something will happen and they'll be like, that is not a proportionate response to whatever inconvenience or whatever situation is happening right now. And it's like, oh yeah, because this is a guy who's got a pretty big emotional debt. He's been suppressing and bottling.
The road rage, right? Yeah.
The road rage.
Like someone cuts you off and next thing you know, it's like 14 people dead. You're like, how did that just happen?
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, and that's, I mean, any example, like think of how much like violence and or like substance abuse and the normalization of numbing out and escaping through, whether it's like video games or alcohol or nicotine, but like, you know, men are dying at rapid rates from deaths of despair through opiate addiction or alcohol or whatever, because all of us are like, trying to like cope with unaddressed feelings because we've been told since this is yay high to like push them away. And it's having devastating consequences for all of society, but also for us as individuals.
At Hey Brother Co., what would you say are some of the, like maybe like the top three qualities that you're trying to instill, harness, build, pick your positive adverb, I guess, within men?
Number one would be an emotional skill set. The ability to relate to other people. Yeah, right from the bio. Yeah, so an emotional skill set. So, like, it truly is a skill and something you have to practice to be able to relate to another human being and express your emotions. Identify what emotions you're feeling and then express them and communicate. Like, communication is a skill. You can go to Toastmasters and learn how to give speeches. And, 100%. like, these are all skills that we need to practice. And we currently have a culture that discourages men from practicing that skill set. So it's not that men and boys are naturally less predisposed for having emotions and for being communicative or nurturing or whatever the qualities. It's that we just are out of practice. We are unskilled. So that's quality number one, is we are a container to build up the emotional skills. I know what I'm feeling and I can tell you how I'm feeling. And when I have really big feelings, really intense ones, for example, anger, that I can actually regulate the intensity of that feeling through the skills I've built up, whether it's breath work or, you know, calling a friend, mutual support, or being able to externalize and express, or go work out, like whatever type of thing, building up that skill. So pillar one, emotional skills. Pillar two, self-confidence and autonomy. I'm not teaching men or boys how to be a man. I'm asking men and boys to interrogate what they've been taught about manhood so that they can decide for themselves what healthy manhood looks like for them, right? And that comes from building up self-confidence, self-esteem, and deciding, I feel good enough about myself where I don't need to be pressured into adhering to the man box, right? And I use this term man box. There's this, like, we try to fit men into this container. Sometimes you can be angry. Sometimes you can be funny. You can be happy-ish when your sports team wins, but not like a giggly, like, joyful. It's like, yes, like, yeah, that's happening, you know? You got to be tough. You got to be, you know, don't cry, all these things. It's like, this is what a man is. Stay inside this box. Out of the box is being expressive, being emotional, being wearing certain clothes, having certain mannerisms, having a limp wrist, maybe trying certain sports instead of others, or like not liking sports at all or whatever. That's outside the man box. So I want to build up self-esteem and self-confidence so that they can dare to jump outside of the man box and be whatever type of man they want. And I am so confident in the innate goodness of the human spirit that a man who has self-esteem, who can decide for himself what type of man he wants to be, I know that somewhere in that it will revolve around, like, kindness, connection with others, an inherent sense of belonging, service to community or family or whatever. Like, I know that's what's going to happen.
That's awesome. I agree. What was the third?
The third would probably be... the third would be specifically anti-patriarchal education, man. Like, we really are out here trying to... do things through a feminist lens, and I think that might bristle a lot of viewers, like, using those terms who maybe are not, honestly, have, like, never read an actual, like, feminist book by bell hooks. You know, The Will to Change Men, Masculinity, and Love is, like, a great first read, but that is also, I think, what distinguishes us from a lot of other men's groups is, like, our pillar is, we advocate for and support women and survivors of abuse, and we welcome, like, we advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. We have queer men and trans men that are part of our spaces, and we want to view things through a lens of intersectional racial justice as well. Like, we're not, so all of these things must require us to deconstruct this value system of patriarchy. So that's a pretty core pillar, but.
Yeah, so that's a big three.
Yeah, it's a big three.
Another thing I was curious about within the realm, how does one develop resilience as a man, would you say? Because I think, you got to have it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like resilience, so on the basic premise that we all need a sense of resilience, I think that's a big one that we try and teach, we try and teach all kids, is that you need resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Because life's going to throw you crazy things, whether it's the flat tire on the highway, whether it's whatever the case may be. And so there has to be a sense of resilience. And I think in men, a lot of the qualities that you're saying are within this box, I think the intent is to almost develop resilience. But again, back to the moderation thing, I think without moderation, you can go one of two ways. You either have no resilience or you have so much of that other quality that it's the brute aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, let's think about how... You know, if David Goggins or Jocko Willink or whatever is this, maybe that, like, more brute side of resilience. Mm-hmm. I want to pose the question, like, do we think that like women are resilient creatures, right? Like us here in this space.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, to me, I think all kids need that.
But all kids need resilience, but like
men, women,
everyone. Let's think of like childbirth. Is this like incredibly like physically painful, arduous, sometimes multi-day, and like pregnancy as well. It's like this like really intense experience.
Absolutely.
To be able to go through that, you have to be resilient. You have to be tough, man. Right? So right. Like all women have this propensity, if uterus owners have this capacity, and in general, like also like periods and menstruation, right? And like that's a constant part of their entire life for the most part, that does bring about a lot of like pain and emotional dysregulation and like hormonal fluctuation, and it's tough, right? And so that though, and the way that they deal with that is, I would not say, like it does cultivate resilience, you have to be resilient, and yet the way that they talk about and cope and deal and express is not through that same lens of like you better get through this childbirth, like you better, you know, push that out, you feel like fucking idiot or whatever, you know, it's not, it's like, it's just different. So it's the result of cultivating resilience is possible and capable without that mindset of like negative reinforcement. And cultivating resilience in men is something that we can do by calibrating our do to say ratio, right? And this is something I struggle with a lot. And I know you struggle with too as an entrepreneur, someone who's got fingers in lots of different pies and like you want to do everything. And I think I have the energy for it all. But if we can calibrate and get a lot more alignment between what we say we're going to do and then what we actually follow through with, that builds up self-confidence because you now have a demonstrated record of like, oh yeah, I did do that, so I can do this. And I did do that, so I can do this. And when we're stuck in the mindset of like, I better do this or else, again, or else I'm a fucking bitch, or else I'm a loser, or else I'm a pussy, or else I'm whatever, we're operating from a fear response. We're operating, I really hope that I do this because I want to avoid shame, and reacting from a place of like avoidance and fear will never be as powerful or purposeful as moving towards something because of like confidence and like self-belief and, you know, excitement or whatever. So yeah, cultivating a better do to say ratio, like as close to 1-to-1 as you can get it. So hard, struggle with it myself.
No doubt.
So hard. But you can start small, you know, like.
So that confidence, that drive towards a 1-to-1 do to say ratio, and if I'm hearing you correctly, would be your catalyst towards having resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And like cultivating an inner sense of self-worth and self-confidence is the ability to reflect at yourself and be like, I am a worthy human being just by virtue of being alive. Like I've, you know, this heart that's beating inside of me has gotten me through every single hard experience I've ever been through. So man, like how awesome is that, right? You know, I can do great things. Like every time I've ever been scared or nervous or joyful and euphoric, every time I've been in love, like this heart has been beating right here and with me through it all. This body's carried me through everything. So like, whew, I can do things. That's crazy. And that is, I mean, that's so much better than being like, man, if I better not mess up, because then I'll be bad. I'll be, you know, unworthy. I'll be whatever. So, I can't do anything. You know, it's mindset, and that's what you coach a lot too.
Very mindset. The mindsets are huge. Yeah. And yeah. I was actually just gonna ask you, when you have someone that comes to you and says, a man that comes to you and says, hey, like, how do I find the parts of me that are going to work towards this passion, work towards mm-hmm. being who I am called, who I ought to be? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you have them find out what those things are about themselves? Because I think we're all given, another big thought of mine is that we're all given these intrinsic gifts, talents, and abilities that are just inherently better than others within us.
Yeah.
The example I always give is like the language part of it, and speaking and word and all of that for me is so much better than the science part of the brain. The science, to me, science just doesn't make sense. I just don't get it the way that I get language, even mm-hmm. like taking Latin, right? Anyway, here nor there. We all have these things within us, but we just have to find out what those are. And of course, that derives a whole lot of other ramifications and calls to action for us too. So what does that look like for someone who comes to you and says like, hey, like, how do I even start?
Yeah, great question. One of the initial exercises, I'll actually speak to the audience. Like, this is something you can do. So you go take a sheet of paper and you write down your top 3 to 5 values. And if you need to Google on your phone or on your computer, like list of values, do that. There's a ton of them, you know. Empathy could be a value. Kindness, compassion, strength, leadership, whatever it might be. Sense of humor, that was something that my roommate Julio told me last night when we were at the gym and I asked him, what do you think one of your top values is? And you write those down, right? And you keep that list nearby, whether it's on your desk or in your wallet or whatever, but you refer to that list often. And if it changes, that's okay. But as you go through your daily life, when you consume content online, when you think about interactions you have with other people, take a moment to reflect back on that list and see if there's alignment between the values that you put down and the way that you are conducting your life or the things that you are exposing yourself to, be it content online, film, media, people, other people. Are the people that you surround yourself with aligned with your values? I think that is a great first step to start to become more aligned with your own integrity, and then either have realization, like, oh no, yeah, like I'm not. Like, if I value kindness or if I value strength, but I'm consuming all of this, like, you know, red pill alpha content that very regularly diminishes other men and calls other men soy boy, beta cuck, blah, 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 like shames other men, that's bullying. That's not strong, right? That's weaponizing shame. Oh, wow. I better check myself on that. That's not being strong. If I value kindness, but the way that I regularly engage on Instagram comments is these, like, biting jokes and trying to tear people down, like, you know, bro got a terrible haircut or whatever, like, man, am I regularly conducting myself with kindness? No. Yeah, yikes. Are the boys that I hang out with, my homies, are they, do we ever look one another in the eye and say, man, I love you, you're a really great friend, and I'm proud of you? Or do we only relate through teasing one another and tearing one another down? You know, that's not kind, right? So that's a really great, like, first step, and I call that the values inventory. It's something that I did learn from Voy Viacek. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I call that exercise the values inventory, and that's something I learned from Voy Viacek, and it's something that we do in Hey Brother Co. in our men's work. Really great first step in identifying, like, where you want to lead your life, whether you find the hobby, the passion, the career pursuit yet. But, like, that's going to come once you decide, like, who do I want to be? How do I want to align myself based on my values?
There's an innate introspection that's so necessary, because without it, and again, it's another one that I've beat a dead horse on, but without introspection, we can just be wreaking havoc on the world around us.
Yeah.
And so similarly, the opposite of that is the introspection allows us to find out these qualities and these values that we hold. What do we do with it from there?
Well, in understanding your own value system, you can liberate yourself from pursuing, like, male validation, right? I think that's what, like, most of us are doing. And men are discouraged from introspection because we're given this rule set of how to be a man, and you should follow the rules, right? Like, follow the bro code. That's why we have virtually zero accountability in our male culture right now. And what I mean by accountability is the strength and bravery to have a, like, call-in conversation, a tough conversation with another man, and say, like, hey man, like, what you did wasn't cool, or hey, you're not following through on this thing, and I know your potential, I know you to be better, what can we do to get alignment? Or you make women uncomfortable sometimes, and like, I don't think that's the person you are. Do you want to be doing that? Like, we're so terrified as men of having that type of conversation with other men, because we believe A, that accountability is conflict. It's not, it's care. And B, we think conflict is going to lead to, like, violence or a separation of a relationship, that I'm going to be abandoned, like, this, my relationship with this other man. Or if I tell the group chat or the group of friends that, hey, dude, let's not make those jokes. Or, like, when we say these types of things, or we talk about women in this way, like, that's not cool. Or, you know, I'm going to get piled on and either ostracized from the group and outgrouped by men, or they're going to be like, oh, it's not that deep, you're too sensitive, they're going to shame me, and I'm, in a sense, going to go lower on the masculinity hierarchy because I'm going to have been identified as, like, a more sensitive or feminine guy, so I'm not going to say shit, I'm not going to say anything, right? So I talk about that and accountability to say most men are not referring, we're not introspecting because we're on autopilot, like, following the rules. So when you do a values inventory and you start men's work and find men and people who are also aligned with, like, this purpose of self-development and honestly, like, going against the grain and saying, like, I've had enough, I'm not going to run on autopilot and just follow the rules, that is what will help instill a sense of self-confidence and allow you to, like, take action and say, like, I don't like my job, or I don't like the people that I surround myself with, or I do, but I want them to grow with me. Like, you will inherently start to take action. But the biggest barrier that I see for a lot of men is a fear of isolation and being outgrouped, because men are really lonely right now, from an emotional connection standpoint, and in general, from all the data, like according to the Equimundo's State of American Men Report 2023, over two-thirds of all young men aged 18 to 23 in America feel that nobody really knows them well. That does not mean that all young men, or two-thirds of young men ages 18 to 23, don't have friends or don't spend time with other people. It means that they don't feel known or seen by those around them. They feel emotionally disconnected. And that is because we are not being vulnerable. We're not normalizing, like taking off that mask, having these exchanges, living the values. We're adhering to that standard, following the rules of like, don't talk about it, tough it out.
I will add to that, personally, I feel like there's a lack of people asking questions in society. I think there's, because it's so self-absorbed, and part of it is probably due to the technological rise, we don't ask questions of other people. And again, speaking personally, like, I'm not one that's going to put myself out there without someone, without pretty much without being prompted. So I feel like there's a call to, just, this is general, just a general tangent, really, a call to action for everyone. Like, be curious, right? Have questions, ask questions. It's the only way that you get to know more about literally anything, whether it's the person across from you, whether it's whatever you're trying to do, whether it's whatever you find an initial thought where you're like, I wonder about this, ask. Mm-hmm. Like, just put it out there.
Yeah.
I mean, the same time that we Google a million and one things a day, so why don't we do the same thing with the people that are around us?
Yeah.
Like, you're interested in coffee? Guess who the best person to learn learn about coffee is? People at the coffee shop, right? Like, things like that. So ask questions. I feel like that's so important. And then all of a sudden, maybe that two-thirds would drop. I feel like that's a massive one, because that prompts the taking off of the mask, the, like, I'm not saying anything. Like, me, again, it's, I'm not introverted at all, at all. And so, but I won't offer something unless it's really provoked, more often than not, just because people need an initial interest, I feel like, for that almost. And that's, I guess, like my general tangent on that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that is the it's a really powerful tool also for mitigating anxiety that Justin Baldoni references in his book, Man Enough. He talks about the why ladder, which is, if you're having anxiety, or especially a thought of like not enoughness, I'm not big enough, I'm not strong enough, I'm not man enough, why? Why do I feel that way? Well, because I skipped a workout yesterday. Why? Well, I was feeling really tired. Why? Because I didn't get enough sleep all week and I've been working really hard. And either you can keep going with this why ladder, or at one of those junctions, you can be like, oh, like, so my time has been well spent. I have this project I'm working really hard on, and so I like haven't had the energy, and that's okay. And it doesn't mean that I'm not good enough. Or this person didn't respond to my text. That means they hate me. Well, why didn't they respond to my text? Maybe they're busy, you know? Maybe it's not that. So asking questions and asking why is like super powerful. You're right. In all senses, you absolutely should do that. And that is what honestly started me on like my journey, like deciding to take, you know, a gender studies class or classes, like an entire year of them, and just be like, well, men are like this. Why? You know, men don't cry. Why? Well, because they're supposed to be strong. Well, what does that mean? Yeah.
Two questions for you before we kind of dive into our, I have a litany that I end every episode with.
Yeah.
First one, do you see any space of this on the contrary? So do you see any women spaces out there that are doing similar to what you're doing? I feel like, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, great question. So there like, are...
Let me finish my thought, because it sounds ambiguous. I just feel like in Cleveland, there's plenty of them, but that's not for me to say. I'm asking you the question.
No, I do think that there are, this is actually an area of growth and opportunity for me, is to actually get more connected with, because I do get this question more frequently than I have been prepared for. So I'm not as well connected with women's spaces. I have been so dialed in on like this, like men's
work
and like staying in my lane. So I do know that they are inherently more prevalent, and there are lots of retreat spaces and, you know, like women's community. But I also think that our society does kind of inherently lend itself more to women forming community and having different types of bonds and more emotionally intimate bonds with one another. So I see there as less of a pressing. No, that's actually not true. I don't feel that way. I don't feel that there's less of a pressing need for women. I think everyone benefits from like emotional work, and also there are spaces out there. I'd love to find some of the ones in Cleveland and also nationally and refer them outward. But I've been really hyper focused on, you know, men's spaces. So I know individual like women's coaches and folks and like podcast resources, but in terms of actual like women's groups and or healing circles, I'm not as familiar.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah.
Second question I have for you. Earlier you mentioned Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
What, I'm a lover of Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
So I'm curious on where is your hesitation with Jordan Peterson?
I think that Jordan Peterson is, again, exploiting our collective like father wound as a society to represent a father archetype and appear very, very convincing and authoritative on matters of life that, in his perspective, reinforce conservative values, traditional gender roles, hierarchy, and shame. And he is not credentialized to actually speak to most of what he is recommending. And he has taken a deal with Ben Shapiro's media news network. And he himself has self-admitted that like that was just a financial decision. So especially presently, like more recently in the past couple of years, a lot of what he says is based on a financial incentive and motive and less on like truly wanting to help people or motivate people. And he has so many discrepancies with how he represents himself as like a climate expert and someone who was on like a United Nations climate panel, which he like was not. And he really does try to leverage some of his credentials to make himself seem more authoritative. And then the way that he speaks, and he always dresses in a suit, like he represents this like trustworthy fatherly figure, which is why he has like risen in popularity. But even his like lobster anecdote and like speaking about serotonin and serotonergic responses and reactors and why SSRIs make you weak and a loser, like that is not based in science. Like many people who actually study, you know, lobsters are not mammals and they're not mammalian, and the way that they experience and or like adapt to serotonin and other hormones is different than humans, you know, metabolize and experience them. But one of Jordan Peterson's like most famous and like well-regarded speeches on why hierarchies are essential and domination is so important is because of this like lobster theory, and that lobsters, you know, like shrivel up, and if you're on SSRIs, you're a loser. And that's like just frankly not based in science. And yet it sounds so convincing, and it is very, very comforting for a lot of people, because the things that he says are very closely aligned with the system of values that we've already all been indoctrinated into, which is a patriarchal one, one that does enforce hierarchies and domination. And so what he says is comfortable to what I know already to be true. And society is progressing in various ways, and some of these systems are being dismantled and questioned. And like, as a collective, human beings have less trust in institutions and authority figures now. So that feels confusing, so I'm going to listen to someone who has a lot of, you know, rules and order and structure, and the opposite of order is like this chaos. So I think that he's, while I appreciate how many men truly have, and people truly have like found themselves or motivated themselves and healed in many ways because of what he has said, so like that is a positive outcome. I also think that his framing of, yeah, like if you take SSRIs, you're a loser, or, you know, we need men to be men again, like that's super, super harmful and is like directly in contradiction to my own value system. And then my last point, though, is as well as like, he does not represent physically, values wise, the way he shows up in the world does not represent what he says other people should represent. Jordan Peterson is not a big alpha domineering man that, and yet he encourages every other man to like return to tradition and to be dominant and to have these traditional gender roles where women should be subservient and should not dress in certain ways in the workplace and like all of this. So
outside of the political realm for Jordan Peterson, like the part that intrigues me is because he is a psychologist, right? Clinical psychologist, has that background, had been in practice for a long time. I feel like he has a wide experience of thoughts around mindsets and around why the way we think. Mm-hmm. So when I have observed some of his speeches and listened to some of the things that he's put, read some of his books, he, to me, when he says like dominate, I think it was referring more so to like our thought process. And I think mm-hmm. he means like, doesn't mean dominate in the way that, say, a guy like David Goggins is, who again, really isn't all that physically imposing, but regardless, the physical sense of it, and more so like dominate your thoughts in the realm of like one of his big things is to be a warrior, right? Like we all have to be a warrior within our own minds, because what he's saying, and I almost feel like there's actually a connection between the two of you, is that you have to know your own thoughts. You have to develop a confidence. You have to do one of these things. And the lobster, to touch on in a second, but another one of his big pushes would be, right, like the clean your room first, mm-hmm. which is a huge, people have made a mockery of it on one end, and then people have bought in and loved it on the other end. There's mm-hmm. really seemingly no middle ground. But the premise is, if you can get your thoughts orderly, if you can get your room orderly, which is like one of the main areas in only realms of our control, it's that autonomy piece that you touched on earlier. If we can use that to get that orderly, to get that within line, mm-hmm. then we can have our thoughts, I feel like, in clicking, in motion, mm-hmm. to figure out what the other aspects of what are our values. Like, if you're in disarray, how are you ever going to know what you want to do?
Yeah. The language of dominating your emotions and control is, again, it's just like, it's patriarchal language. That's why I'm very deliberate about, I want to regulate my emotions, because emotions are natural. I can't control or master or dominate like a feeling that is going to arise naturally, because life is unpredictable.
But so I think he's saying thoughts.
And thoughts, like, that's what we're already all doing. We're trying, especially as men, to kill off parts of ourselves from boyhood. And the types of language that Jordan Peterson uses encourages that mindset and behavior and a return to some sort of tradition. But the tradition has got us to where we are today with current levels of male suicide. And I do not trust any clinical psychologist who decries all pharmaceutical remedies for the very real mental health issues that men are facing. I also don't trust anybody who has suffered from addiction and yet also kind of shames people who do experience other vices or struggle with vices, the majority of whom are like men and or poor people, and like shames them for that when he himself. So I do not find him to be a man of integrity that has a very strong do to say ratio or practices what he preaches. And I think that there are so many other sources of self-help and or routine and inspiration to become organized in your home environment or in your life, declutter, like Marie Kondo, Spark Joy, you know, great book on how to literally declutter your life, and like great, great alternative perspective there that has nothing to do with you're a weak loser if you can't dominate and learn to control the beast. And regardless of, again, Jordan Peterson's personal life, if teenage boys are taking sound bites of what he says and setting them to videos of them working out and getting really big and strong, but also starting to take testosterone and steroids from a way too early age because they think they need to become this like monster and animal and before they can whatever, like that is harmful. That's really harmful. And it's so prevalent right now, right? And it is not language which encourages men to become emotionally intelligent or skilled. It is this language of, yeah, like boxing, domination, like whatever. But for the people that it helps, I'm grateful it has helped them, because who's to say if they would have been helped by someone else? And also, I think that there are way better role models who are not trying to, again, yeah, like profit off of collective insecurity and align with traditional values. There's better places that I can be told to like make my bed, to be respectful of others, to treat other people in the way that I want to be treated. Those are my thoughts there on Mr. Peterson. But whatever helps.
Because transparently, I think a lot of what the two of you are saying is just coming from, again, different perspectives with mm-hmm. really the same, like it's just like a different modus to get to the same point is almost mm-hmm. how I view it. That's why I was curious kind of your thoughts on it. Part of what his lobster analogy is that lobsters have like a thick outer skull, right? Mm-hmm. There's skull too, but shell. So he's saying it's like a lobster's lack of awareness for them to roll over and show their tummy and get mm-hmm. killed. as opposed to if they were to roll on their stomach and have their back showing, they would not be crushed, right? So I think that taps into you saying, well, what are your values? Like, you need to know yourself in order to know what you are out there going to do. Much like you're with your experience, right? Like, you knew, okay, this wasn't right. I have to cut this off. I have to make these amends with my mom, with my sister, and really bolster into who you are. You bloomed. And so to me, I think, like, it's almost like they're, again, ending up at the same result, just with different thoughts on it.
Yeah. Well, in the same, you know, lobster analogy, where if he's using as a metaphor for don't roll over, he even could have used, like, you know, dogs submit by rolling over or whatever. But in the same time, he's talking about a crustacean. He does talk about serotonergic receptors and our response to those, like in our endocrine system. And he's comparing crustaceans to mammalians and then using that to infer that if you take SSRIs, if you take medication for diagnosed mental health issues, you are weak and you are a loser who has rolled over and you need to be more powerful and conquer that, which is a horrible, horrible thing to tell someone who is suffering from suicidal ideation, who is suffering from mental health issues that could be genetic, biological, whatever, and is not, it's not as simple as just like conquering the thoughts and feelings. That does, you know, mindset shifts are huge, but it's not as binary as that. There's so many more things that go into it. And again, just the language of domination, there's other ways to go about inspiring people. And if I'm constantly looking over my shoulder in life, thinking that someone is going to jump and attack me and dominate me, and I need to, again, this like warrior archetype, like that's how society has been structured forever, is trying to train men and boys into being this like warrior, tough, like soldier archetype. And it's how we got to where we are, where there's a ton of guys who are taking their own lives all the time because they don't feel enough. We need to kind of abandon our value of this warrior archetype. I mean, Jordan Peterson doesn't care about the warrior archetype. Like, what is he doing for veteran suicide? Like, our warrior class, men who serve in this country and around the world, are some of the people who take their lives the most. And they have lived up to the standard of masculinity, preparing to do extreme violence in wartime. And they are not treated well or respected or have adequate resources. And that becoming a warrior didn't fix their problem. It, like, cost it, right? So less warrior archetype. You can be tough and resilient in all of these different ways, but I don't want you to be a warrior. I want you to be a good community member. You know, I want you to be a good partner. I want you to be a someone who loves animals and the world around you. So the warrior archetype, and that's from bell hooks too, like paraphrasing, but like, the warrior archetype has done devastating, you know, effect on us. But again, my personal thoughts, but I really appreciate you engaging with me on
it. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we all have, like, right, we all have melting pots of ideas, I think, that come and form the stew that we all consume. So
yeah,
just was kind of curious on that, given, like I was mentioning, I feel like you both are ending at the same place. And I suppose I have a more favorable view of his heart than I perhaps you do, which is here nor there. So I guess that was part of my line of questioning. With that, though, I would say all of the three of us would agree that, which is another big principle of the show, is that I think that people who live gratefully, people who have gratitude on their mind, tend to be, or not tend to, but are happier, more joyful individuals than those who do not have gratitude in their life and live gratefully. What role does gratitude play in your life, Johnny?
Gratitude is very aligned with the emotion of joy for me, and joy is an emotion that reminds me to be present, because all emotions are just like signals and messages. And I try to say thank you and I love you as much as possible to the people that I am grateful for and that I love and who have been an essential part of my journey. Amen. Because I am by no means this like self-made or whatever. Like, I think that's a ludicrous archetype to claim at any point in time, because there are so many people and institutions and things that have contributed to my growth and development. And as frequently as possible, I try to write letters to people, send voice messages, and not let things go unsaid. Yeah, voice messages. But I'm a big writer of letters. So, the gratitude to me, very, very like verbal, active, or written expression. I don't like to leave things unsaid. So for the people that have had impact on my life, or even just like friends, sometimes week to week, I was like, hey, sent a voice message like, I was just thinking about you this week, and I sent the one to my friend Logan. I was like, thank you so much, Logan, for spending time with me this summer and teaching me new acrobatic skills, because it's now this like realm of my life that I love and brings me so much joy, and you are the foundation of that. So I sent him a voice message randomly one morning on a walk, and then a couple days later he was like, dude, I listened to that like while out with some friends, and it started making me cry, and like I was so happy, you know.
That's awesome.
It was nice. But
yeah, I think gratitude's so much of an action too, right? Like you're saying, like it's putting yourself out there in a way that's showing that appreciation too. It's like whatever that means is voice message, letter, and so forth. Kind of the opposite of that, or really not the opposite, but another big question is, when we look at our life, I feel like we all have regrets to some capacity. Do you have any regrets in your life that you can pinpoint, and how have you developed from them?
I think I regret, so pretty much every year of my life, even this year, unfortunately, I have struggled with suicidal ideation, and my mental health has been something that I've really struggled with. But it wasn't until last year was the first time that I ever like told anybody about it. I told my friends John and Lewis, and they told me to tell my mom and my sister, and then my mom and my sister helped get me an appointment to my current therapist, who I've been seeing weekly for the past year.
It's great advice out of them to tell your mom and your sister, by the way.
Yeah. Really grateful. So grateful.
There you go. Yeah.
So what I regret, but do not judge or blame myself for, is not telling someone I need help now, which are four incredibly potent words from Kevin Hines, who talks a lot about brain pain, and he's a huge mental health and advocate for folks suffering from suicidal ideation and depression. That is like one regret. And also, like where I sit right now, I'm sure I might have a different answer on a different day, but as I said in the earlier part of the interview, like everything that I've been through and everything that I've done it has helped me get everything, even the bad things, even the mistakes I've made. And for so much of my life as a survivor of childhood domestic violence and narcissistic abuse, and the subsequent diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which does inherently shatter your self-esteem and feelings of a sense of self. For most of my life, I've thought that I was a bad person without ever having a demonstrated record of doing bad things to other people. And I am just now out of the woods of that and realizing, like, I actually haven't done anything so crazy or horrible. So where is that coming from? And not super big on the regrets, but there's always that, as we've talked about, like sometimes procrastinate too much or spread myself too thin so I can't go as much all in on one thing. But from most of it, no regrets.
Yeah, people who are out there willing to kind of put themselves out there and go and endeavor on things tend to view regrets, I think, that way, where it's like, yeah, these things have happened. I wish I could have done a couple things differently, but in the grand scheme of things, I'm here where I am now working on the things that I'm doing because of all these things. So it's like, is it a regret? I don't know, right? And I feel like that's a very typical response. and I love it. I'm the same way. I'm like, well, there's certainly, you wish you treated people better in different instances. You wish something like that. But it's like, in the grand scheme of all of it, it's like, okay, if you've made your amends, if you've done what you can to move forward, it's like, what more can you do? Because you've learned lessons. Anyway, next one for you. This is a new one that I added last episode, and I actually love this question. I think it's so important to have things on our calendar that we look forward to, because Jesse Itzler shouted him out the first time, shouted him out again. He wrote the New York Knicks theme song way back in the day. He's a comedian, he's a rapper, he's a million and one things, but Jesse Itzler's awesome. And one of the things for him is, he's like, I always do a couple things every year that I basically define that year. So whether it's going to Jamaica, whether it's, going to Egypt and seeing the pyramids, whatever it is, running a marathon, whatever it is, right? He has certain things that he looks at and says, like, okay, I can look back at 2024 and I did this, this, and this. What is on your calendar that you're looking forward to?
For next year or like for the future?
Yeah.
One of them, the next year's father-son retreat.
Nice.
Be my third one. And
congrats,
I know it's going to be like each, the first two built upon one another and were bigger than the last. Like that is so exciting to me to be able to do that work and see like, not a lot of other folks are doing specifically that. So it's something that's unique to me, and I just love it. I'm really excited.
Congratulations again.
Yeah, thank you. Another thing is taking my mom and my sister back to South Africa in February. That's where my family's originally from.
Heck yeah.
I took them back for both of their first time being back in South Africa in 16 years. I did that last February, in 2023. And I was able to take my family, like everyone, on vacation and have my mom like reconnect with her parents and her siblings for the first time in like over a decade.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, I'm not quite at the level where I can do that every year, but now 2025 in February, we're going to spend a couple of weeks being able to reconnect. And so I'm really, really looking forward to that. And another thing that I'm looking forward to in the near term is on Saturday, I'm going to go to San Francisco for a week and see several like amazing friends, some of whom are in the Men's Work and Hey Brother Cook community. But one of my best friends in the world since high school, Nina, has moved out there recently, and I miss her a lot because she used to live, you know, we used to be roommates, and we used to live in this area. So I'm like really excited to see her on Sunday and, you know, spend some time with her and just like, you know, see how she's settling into her new life and her new job. And like, really proud of her. So like, I'm going to give her a hug.
That's so great. I'm excited for all of you on all those things. Like, that's what's so cool about it, right? Like, you're glowing right now. You have a smile on your face. Like, that's what's cool. And I think that's the importance that Jesse Itzler highlights when he says, like, you got to have stuff on your calendar to look forward to, because like, all you have to do in the moment then is think about like, oh my God, I can't wait to do these things, right? And it's like, that's immediate. Just like, this is why we do what we do sometimes, you know? Like, you work hard so that you can go back to South Africa and take your family there. Like, that's so motivating. It's so awesome.
Thank you. And I'm also looking forward to the next Hey Brother Co. virtual men's group. It's a 6-week block that starts on November 7th, and you can register for it on my website,
which will be linked in the description below while we're at it. I will have all of Johnny's socials, his business, his personal, all of the links that we discussed in the description below. Again, if you're on YouTube, you might find it in the pinned comment. YouTube still hates me. I don't know. I probably should talk to the videographer about that. I'm just going to put my hands out of that one. Last question for you, Johnny. Do you have any advice specifically to the audience abroad, or to a specific audience, I should say, and just in general, what are your closing thoughts?
Don't be afraid to ask questions, to get to know yourself better and to get to know others better. It can be very uncomfortable to be vulnerable with someone, but it is ultimately the basis for trust and deep relationships. So to all folks out there, lean into building connection with others. That's why we're here. Humans are inherently community-oriented creatures. And to men, dare to ask questions of, are your current relationships fulfilling? And if not, I want you to know you deserve to have fulfilling relationships. You deserve to have expectations of the men around you, that your emotional needs can be met by those connections. And I promise you, when you start daring to ask those questions, it's not gonna lead to confrontation or separation of relationships. It's actually gonna help push you and those around you, but specifically the men around you, to a higher standard of having access to emotions and being close with one another. And also during October, as Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I wanna say that survivors, it is not your fault. I believe you, and I hope that you are able to receive all of the support and resources that you need to move on, and you did not deserve whatever has happened to you.
That's beautifully put.
Yeah.
I mean, nailed it. This is why we open it up. I love to end every episode with it, because then you get monologues basically like that Johnny just did for all of us and for the audience as a whole. So Johnny, thank you so much. Again, episode 49 of the Chaz and Clark podcast was a major hit. So I'm so excited that Johnny Cole was able to be here. Hey Brother Co., got to check it out. Everything will be in the description or the comments below, as you heard about 2 minutes ago. Johnny, thank you so much again for opening up your heart, kind of sharing your experiences with us and your vision for really everything that you have going on. And of course, for the men that are surrounding us and the counterpart, the women as well. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joe. It was an honor. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Everyone, this has been episode 49 of the Chats with Clark podcast. I'm your host, Joe Clark, signing off. See you next time.